Imagine it's late 1963. America is basically grieving this massive national tragedy. Pop culture has effectively just flatlined.
Right, it was a very stagnant moment.
Yeah. And the entire trajectory of global music is about to be accidentally decided by, of all things, a 15-year-old girl in Maryland who's just watching the evening news.
And that singular moment is definitely the flashpoint, you know. But the powder keg had been filling up for years across the Atlantic.
Exactly, which brings us to our mission for this deep dive. We are exploring this really comprehensive historical article by Megan Paz to basically uncover how a transatlantic musical exchange didn't just change the Billboard charts, but fundamentally rewired global youth culture, fashion, and film for you and for, well, everyone.
It's a huge story.
It is. Okay, let's unpack this. Because the actual origin story doesn't begin with British culture invading America. It actually starts in the late 1950s with British kids desperately trying to copy American blues and rock.
Right. And what's fascinating here is the sheer lack of resources those British kids face. I mean, after World War II, the UK was still dealing with heavy rationing and import restrictions.
Wow, still.
Oh, yeah. Young musicians couldn't just, you know, walk into a store and buy an American Fender Stratocaster. They didn't have the gear. So their early commercial attempts to replicate American rock sounded incredibly thin.
That makes sense.
Yeah, so they improvised. They ended up pulling from traditional jazz to create what became known as the skiffle craze.
And the mechanics of skiffle are what actually changed the DNA of the music, right? Like, when you can't afford a bass guitar, you literally build a T-chest bass out of a wooden box and a broomstick.
Totally.
You replace a drum kit with a washboard. That DIY limitation forced a completely different time signature. It stripped out that swinging, laid-back shuffle of American blues and replaced it with this driving, frantic, acoustic thrash.
Yeah, and that percussive urgency became the engine of the entire movement. By 1962, as those skiffle bands finally got their hands on electric instruments in places like Liverpool, they layered that frantic rhythm under rock and roll.
And that's Merseybeat.
Exactly. That evolution birthed Merseybeat.
I was trying to conceptualize this, and it essentially functioned like a cultural digital filter.
Oh, that's a good way to put it.
Right. Like, the raw material is American rock and blues. It travels across the Atlantic, gets run through that highly percussive, working-class British skiffle filter, and then gets exported back to America sounding entirely alien.
Yeah, and the pipeline for that export was actually tested before the major bands arrived. The proof of concept came in 1962 with a British instrumental group called the Tornadoes.
Oh, right.
Yeah, they released a track called Telstar, which actually became the first record by a British group to hit number one on the US Hot 100.
And looking at how that track was made explains so much about the British approach to production. I mean, it wasn't just a catchy melody. It was written and produced by Joe Meek, who was operating this crazy DIY studio above a leather goods shop in London.
Yeah, literally an apartment studio.
Right. And he was using early electronics, heavily compressed audio signals, a strange keyboard called a clavioline, and intense tape delay. He engineered the space-age texture that major American studios simply weren't producing yet.
So the pipeline exists, but it's just a trickle at that point. Getting from that single instrumental hit to a global tidal wave required a bizarrely delayed sequence of events.
Yeah, I was looking at the timeline, and it is crazy to think this whole explosion hinges on Walter Cronkite needing filler content.
The delay is staggering, honestly. By late 1963, Beatlemania is causing a total frenzy in the UK. The Washington Post finally runs a story about them in late October.
Right.
Then they play the Royal Variety performance for the Queen Mother in early November, which forces the American television networks to actually pay attention.
CBS actually had a segment about them edited and ready to go.
They did. It was slated to air on the CBS Morning News on November 22nd, 1963.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Obviously, that segment was shelved. The assassination of President John F. Kennedy plunged the nation into mourning. For weeks, the American public was completely disconnected from anything resembling pop culture.
The nation is grieving, and then on December 10th, Walter Cronkite is searching the archives for something, anything remotely uplifting to end his evening broadcast.
Exactly.
He pulls that shelved Beatlemania segment, and sitting in Silver Spring, Maryland, is 15-year-old Marcia Albert.
There she is.
Right. She watches this joyful, chaotic footage and writes a letter to Carol James, a disc jockey at local station WWDC, asking, you know, why American radio isn't playing this music.
Wait, so if it weren't for a 15-year-old girl, would the timeline of rock history have shifted?
I mean, probably. The mechanism of what happens next is pure, organic, viral demand. Carol James manages to acquire a copy of I Want to Hold Your Hand from an airline stewardess.
That's wild. Yeah. And on December 17th, he has Marcia Albert introduce it live on the air.
And the phone lines just instantly jam. Record stores are flooded with teenagers demanding a single that hasn't even been pressed in the U.S. yet.
Right, it didn't exist here.
The demand is so ferocious that Capitol Records is forced into a corner. They abandon their entire marketing schedule and rush release the record on December 26th, 3 weeks early.
And the demographic timing of that December 26th release is the real catalyst here.
Oh, because of school.
Exactly. Teenagers are on Christmas break, they have autonomous free time, they are listening to the radio constantly, and they're gathered together. Capitol capitalized on this hyper-concentrated word of mouth.
Which sets the stage for the February 9th Ed Sullivan Show appearance. We all know 73 million people tuned in. But analyzing the demographic data of that broadcast reveals why it fundamentally changed the industry.
How so?
TV wasn't just a medium anymore. It functioned as a synchronized consumption engine. Capitol Records realized they could bypass regional radio markets and instantly dictate youth consumer behavior nationwide.
That's a great point. And Michael Ross points out this profound irony in the source text. The biggest, most rebellious, disruptive moment in popular music history was actually broadcast through the most traditional, corporately controlled medium imaginable.
The ultimate hearth and slippers medium.
Exactly. The rebellion was delivered directly to the American living room.
And once that broadcast aired, the statistics became absurd. By April 4, 1964, the Beatles held the top five spots on the Billboard Hot 100.
The top five.
Yeah, the top five. By May 1965, British acts nearly swept the entire top 10 with everyone from Peter and Gordon to Herman's Hermits, The Kinks, and Dusty Springfield.
Oh, Dusty Springfield.
Yeah, who AllMusic rightly categorized as the finest white soul singer of her era. But here's where it gets really interesting. The music flooding in wasn't a monolith.
Right, there was a huge split.
Yeah, think of this musical invasion like a house party. The Beatles were the safe, parent-friendly guests allowed in through the front door. But then you had bands like the Rolling Stones and the Animals, who were the gritty outsiders basically sneaking in through the back window. Looking at how this music functions sociologically, it feels less like a stylistic choice and more like a massive cultural money laundering operation.
Well, if we connect this to the bigger picture, that is a highly accurate way to describe the socio-racial dynamic at play.
Really?
Yeah. The grittier British bands were essentially reviving African-American blues and rhythm and blues, a genre that had been systematically marginalized in the United States.
Right. When Black American artists played that music in the 1950s, mainstream white radio dismissed it as race music.
Exactly. It carried a cultural taboo. But when that exact same sonic structure was shipped overseas, stripped of its original racial context, and performed by white British youth in suits and Chelsea boots, it was suddenly deemed safe enough for white American teenagers to consume as rebellion. I mean, the Rolling Stones topped the Hot 100 eight times, primarily by selling American blues back to the American suburbs.
Wait, I actually have to challenge this romanticized idea of the Stones or the Animals representing some authentic, gritty rebellion.
Okay, go on.
We look back and frame them as raw, untamed bluesmen sticking it to the establishment. But looking at the industry machinery behind them, it was just as manufactured as the squeaky clean pop acts. I mean, Eric Burdon, the lead singer of the Animals, explicitly admitted in Pace's article that their management tried to bring in a choreographer to dictate how they moved on stage.
Yeah, their management heavily curated that danger.
Entirely. They were forcing them into strange costumes. And most tellingly, Burdon said they were explicitly gagged upon arriving in America. They were ordered under no circumstances to mention the Vietnam War. That isn't rebellion. That's a highly controlled corporate branding exercise designed to look dangerous while keeping the advertisers perfectly comfortable.
That really reveals the core tension of the entire invasion. The recording industry recognized that youth culture craved the aesthetic of friction and anti-authoritarianism. They were happy to supply the haircut and the distorted guitar, but they actively neutralized the political and social friction that birthed the blues in the first place.
You can clearly see that tension when you look at how the American entertainment industry panicked in response to. You can't have an invasion without a defense.
Right.
And the landscape was brutal for the old guard. Instrumental surf music was effectively eradicated from the charts. The clean-cut teen idols lost all their traction. Traditional television programs like Sing Along with Mitch were immediately scrapped for shows like Shindig and Hullabaloo, which were purpose-built to replicate the frantic editing and energy of the British acts.
They were trying to adapt on the fly. But while those casualties were real, Paes' research systematically debunks one of the most pervasive myths of this era.
Which is?
The idea that the British invasion destroyed the commercial momentum of Black American artists. The data simply does not support that.
Oh, yeah. I was looking at the Motown numbers during this exact window, and it's remarkable. How did an independent Detroit label not just survive, but actively expand its market share while the Beatles were locking out the top five?
It all comes down to Berry Gordy's business mechanics. Motown survived because Hitsville, USA operated like a precision auto plant.
Detroit.
Right. Gordy implemented an assembly line quality control system that relied on elite in-house songwriters, the Funk Brothers rhythm section, and rigorous artist development. They didn't try to compete on British terms. They competed by producing flawless, mathematically perfect pop architecture.
That's incredible.
Yeah, acts like the Supremes, the Temptations, and Stevie Wonder actually secured their first major crossover hits right at the peak of the invasion.
So Motown holds the line through sheer structural perfection. But the reaction from white American rock bands took a completely different and, frankly, hilarious approach.
It was very theatrical.
Very. They relied almost entirely on literal visual semiotics. You had groups like Paul Revere and the Raiders dressing up in full literal Revolutionary War uniforms.
I know, it's so absurd.
Gary Puckett and the Union Gap put on Civil War regalia. So what does this all mean? Why did Americans feel the need to weaponize their history to fight a pop culture trend?
Because musically, they just couldn't compete with the sheer volume and novelty of the British output. I mean, since the end of World War II, America had been the undisputed global exporter of youth culture. Denim, rock and roll, leather jackets, that was American currency.
Right.
Having their own cultural exports repackaged and sold back to them induced a profound loss of control. Wearing military uniforms was a visual, somewhat desperate attempt to reclaim a sense of American masculine identity over a medium that felt hijacked.
And when the historical cosplay didn't work, some bands just resorted to outright absurdity. The Garage Band, the Barbarians, tried to attack the masculinity of the British acts directly. They released a track with the lyrics, "You're either a girl or you come from Liverpool." Yeah. But other American musicians realized resistance was futile and just started synthesizing the sound.
And synthesis was definitely happening.
Yeah.
Roger McGuinn of the Byrds is the perfect example of that. He openly admitted that while British bands were a huge influence, they were essentially just utilizing American folk licks. He famously said it's not that big a ripoff.
It's the ultimate game recognizes game realization.
Mm-hmm.
But on the commercial side, you had American bands adopting fake British names just to trick radio programmers.
Oh, yeah.
You had the Buckinghams out of Chicago. You had the Sir Douglas Quintet playing Tex-Mex music out of Texas, but using an aristocratic British moniker to bypass the bias of local DJs.
And that bias existed because the invasion could no longer be contained to just the radio. It spilled over into everything Americans could see, wear, and watch. The American media apparatus essentially declared London the global epicenter of cool, which led to a total cultural takeover.
Hollywood completely surrendered its aesthetic dominance. You look at the Academy Awards during this period, British productions are sweeping the board. Lawrence of Arabia takes 7 Oscars, My Fair Lady takes 8, Mary Poppins is massive. And the introduction of Sean Connery as James Bond completely redefined the cinematic framework for modern masculinity.
And that shift on screen was mirrored by an economic revolution in the fashion industry.
Right.
The Beatles had already normalized longer hair and tailored suits for men, but the mod fashions emerging from London dismantle the American textile status quo entirely.
We all know the icons, right? Mary Quant's miniskirts,
yeah.
Models like Twiggy. But looking beyond the aesthetics, this fundamentally disrupted the economics of fashion.
How so?
Well, moving away from the highly structured conservative silhouettes of the 1950s, which required strict tailoring and massive yards of fabric, to the mass-produced, off-the-rack, miniskirt democratized youth fashion, it allowed teenagers to consume trends at a vastly accelerated rate.
And American culture was just infatuated with that accelerated, liberated lifestyle. The writer John Crosby famously said that he wanted to import the whole Chelsea girl with her Life is Fabulous's philosophy to America with instructions to bore from within.
Wow, bore from within.
Yeah, it was a total obsession with the independent British sensibility. And Robert J. Thompson, a pop culture scholar, argues that this dynamic is precisely what pushed the counterculture into the mainstream. The British invasion provided the Trojan horse to smuggle fringe anti-establishment ideas into middle-class American living rooms under the guise of catchy pop music.
And reading through Posse's research, the most striking realization for me is that this invasion never truly ended. This cultural recycling loop never actually closed, it just shape-shifted.
Yeah, it just evolved.
Exactly. The aesthetic DNA of 1964 fed directly into 1970s power pop, you can hear it, engineered into the Max My Sharona. And when MTV launched in the 1980s, the heavy reliance on visual presentation triggered a massive second British invasion with bands like Duran Duran and Culture Club. The infrastructure built by that first wave simply became the permanent foundation of modern pop culture.
Which really ties all these threads together. And this raises an important question for you to consider about how we define originality in art.
Oh, absolutely.
We tend to canonize the British invasion as this singular, explosive moment of unprecedented genius.
Right.
But when you strip away the mythology, the biggest revolution in music history was essentially a transatlantic game of telephone.
Right.
Black American blues, translated by white British youth, repackaged by corporate management, and sold back to white American teenagers with every slight mistranslation, producing a completely new cultural paradigm.
It all circles back to that digital filter analogy. You put the raw material in, apply the socioeconomic constraints of a different culture, and it outputs something that permanently alters the landscape. Which leaves me with one final thought for you to mull over.
Let's hear it.
We've spent this entire deep dive analyzing a phenomenon built on physical constraints. Vinyl records shipped across the ocean on boats, a teenager writing a physical letter to a local DJ, the entire country waiting weeks for a song to drop.
Right, it took time.
Exactly. But in today's hyper-connected, internet-driven reality, where a global trend crosses borders on TikTok in microseconds rather than taking weeks via shipped vinyl, could a localized, geographically distinct phenomenon like the British invasion ever happen again? Or has the internet dissolved those cultural borders entirely, leaving us in a state of permanent, indistinguishable global invasion?
That is a fascinating point.
Something to think about next time a new artist mysteriously dominates your feed. Thanks for taking this deep dive with us.